Walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Welcome to Dog-Eared Reads, Kodiak Public Library Association's monthly program focusing on literacy, library resources, and opportunities that are happening in our community at our Kodiak Public Library. This month, people are out fishing, out gardening, and out having a great time. We are going to be focusing on adventures people are having or have had in the past. This show is dependent upon our trusty volunteers, and this month we have several who are here to help us out. Sarah Purcellin has volunteered to do some readings, and she's reading from Gaining Daylight, a book of essays by Sarah Lowen. Athenia Large, one of KPLA's board members, talks with Lexa Myers, who tells us about hybrids and her favorite gardening books and fiction books from the Kodiak Public Library. In our Beyond the Cover segment, we will replay an interview with Sandor Katz done by Tate and Sheridan about 2 years ago when Sandor visited us. In the book review segment, we have Bob Reed reviewing The Wild Colorado by Richard Maurer, the story of the 1850s when Fred Dellenbaugh, who was 17 years old, went on an expedition up the Colorado River. Bob says it's his favorite historic read for 2017. You'll hear news of the Kodiak Public Library Association's activities and an upcoming author visit. If you love the resources at the Kodiak Public Library, or you're an avid reader, why not join us on this show? We are always looking for new talent to share their love of reading with the community. You can contact us through Facebook or at our email account, which is kpla.alaska@gmail.com, or you can call me, Lori Madsen, the chairman this year of the Public Library Association, at 942-5552. Love to hear from you if you're interested in joining us. Well, let's get on with the show. First, we'll start out with Bob Ross's review of The Wild Colorado.
Thank you for allowing me to bring you another in the series of book reviews from your Kodiak Public Library. My name is Bob Ross, and it is my privilege to share with you The Wild Colorado by Richard Maurer. This 2000 Scholastic Incorporated publication is the true adventure of Fred Dellenbaugh, age 17, on the second Powell expedition into the Grand Canyon. My best historical read thus far in 2017. It was in the 1850s that the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon were the last unmapped and unexplored region in the United States. An expedition led by Army Lieutenant Joseph Christmas Ives in 1858 started from the Gulf of California, mouth of the Colorado River, traveling by steamboat, then rowboat, and finally on foot to map and explore more than 500 miles of that lower reach into the beginning of the Grand Canyon. It was there impractical for them to continue the expedition past that particular point in the Grand Canyon. The American Civil War put a hold on expeditions while this country tore itself apart in a bloodbath over states' rights and slavery. It was not until 1869, the year that the Transcontinental Railroad saw completion, that Major John Wesley Powell, a Civil War veteran and now an Illinois University professor of natural sciences, arrived on the scene. After several field trips into the Rocky Mountains, he decided to attempt something that no one had done before. He would explore and map the Colorado River, that last unmapped region of the West, from the upriver side. He would try to prove the theory that the Green and Grand Rivers of the Rocky Mountain Highlands connected to the Colorado River at some point downstream, and he planned to map the unknown region to Lieutenant Ives' ending map point. The first expedition consisted of 9 men in 4 boats with 10 months of supplies. After 950 miles, more than 300 waterfalls, canyon walls up to 4,000 feet, rapids sometimes extending 3/4 of a mile at a stretch, and places where it was impossible to carry a boat around, 2 boats and 5 men completed this first transit of the Grand Canyon. 1 man deserted early in the expedition. 1 boat was crushed in rapids with loss of 2,000 pounds of equipment plus a third of their food, and 3 men mutinied toward the end of the expedition to hike out of the canyon and make their way back to civilization on foot. They were killed by Indians. Mapping of the canyon became a secondary mission to basic survival for this first expedition, but they did prove that it could be done. The second expedition in 1871, which is the crux of this book, was necessary because of mapping and photography of the river course. This second expedition consisted of 10 men and 3 boats designed with watertight storage areas. Supply caches were arranged at intervals at certain points along the Grand Canyon. The journey began in May of 1871 and ended in September of 1872. I would not presume to spoil this adventure, awaiting for your reading, but I can state without the period pictures and drawings that I would not believe that anyone would attempt this journey once, let alone twice, as the expedition leader, Major Powell, had done. All the more remarkable, Major Powell had only one arm. He lost the other at Shiloh in the Civil War. That you might not have heard of Powell's second expedition is explained in the second paragraph of the epilogue to this book on page 109, which I quote from now. Strangely enough, the second Powell expedition was never mentioned in the official record. For reasons that puzzled Fred and angered the other men, the major made it appear that events during the second expedition happened during the first. The result was a seamless, exciting story, with all the mishaps and uncertainties of the first trip, combined with the wide-ranging exploration and scientific accomplishments of the second. But it was deceptive as history. The names of those on the first expedition became very well known. Those on the second were not even recorded. Fred and his comrades found themselves in the unpleasant position of being judged liars for claiming to have voyaged down the Colorado with the major. My interest in Alaska history, and history in general, postdates my formal education. It is a joy and a wonder of discovery that sharing through these book reviews, these great reads, such as The Wild Colorado and The Impossible Mission, that motivates and re-energizes my appetite for history. I want to thank you for joining me today. Until next time, when we journey to the Antarctic from the comfort of our warm armchair, I bid you good day.
Thank you very much, Bob. That sounds like an exciting read. Coming up next, we have a replay of an interview with Sandor Katz done by Tate Sheridan right before his visit to Kodiak in 2015.
In today's segment of Beyond the Cover, we'll chat with Sandor Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, Inside America's Underground Food Movements. Wild Fermentation has been called the manifesto in the Bible for do-it-yourself fermentists. His most recent book, The Art of Fermentation, won the James Beard Award, and the New York Times calls him one of the unlikely rock stars of the American food scene. Katz lives in Tennessee and describes himself as a fermentation revivalist. He's given workshops and spoken all over the country. The workshop's description reads, "Come learn how simple it is to make your own kimchi, kefir, and other fermented delicacies. Learn about the healing qualities and the nutritional importance of live culture ferments, as well as their illustrious history and integral role in human cultural evolution. Empower yourself with simple techniques for fermenting these healthful foods in your home. Be part of the fermentation revival." Sandor Katz, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What's fermentation?
Well, broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. Generally, we use this word in relation to foods and beverages. So they're foods and beverages that are created by microbial action.
And so what are some common ferments?
Well, I mean, you know, most people in most parts of the world enjoy products of fermentation on a daily basis. You know, one scholar actually estimated that one-third of all food that human beings eat has been transformed by fermentation before we put it in our mouths. Some examples would be bread, cheese, cured meats, coffee, chocolate. You know, the list goes on and on. I mean, up in the north of Alaska, you know, people never could have settled in the Arctic region without, you know, having techniques for effectively preserving, you know, fish and marine mammals from summer when the waterways are accessible to get them through the winter. So that's fermentation. You know, sauerkraut, kimchi, and other methods of preserving vegetables from seasons of plenty to get people through seasons of relative scarcity. That's fermentation. So, fermentation actually has, you know, many varied manifestations. Soy sauce is fermentation. Fish sauce is fermentation. Vinegar, which is the base of all the condiments that, you know, we enjoy in the standard American diet, you know, those are all based on fermentation. So, you know, fermentation is very, very integral to, you know, culinary traditions, you know, in the U.S. and really in every other part of the world as well.
In your book, you talk about the difference between wild and cultured fermentation. What's the difference there?
Well, I mean, wild fermentation really describes fermentation based on the organisms that are spontaneously present on the food that you are fermenting or to a limited degree in your environment. You know, conceptually, all fermentations had to begin as wild fermentation events in some particular place. But we've learned, lots of different ways of perpetuating these cultures. So let's say something like yogurt. Yogurt began as a spontaneous event somewhere. The first person who made yogurt did not have mature yogurt to use as a starter. But if you or I want to make yogurt, all we do is get some, mature live culture yogurt and use that as a starter. And so we perpetuate the culture by introducing a small amount of it into the next batch. Whereas something like sauerkraut, nobody really uses a starter for sauerkraut because all the bacteria that you need are so abundantly present on the vegetables that you are fermenting. So wild fermentation, simply is a way of describing ferments based on the organisms that are present on the food, or in the environment, whereas culturing implies that you're introducing some sort of a starter.
So then you recommend just using wild or cultured based on what type of fermentation you want, or do you usually prefer one over another for people just starting out?
Well, I mean, really, for most people, I would recommend as a starting place fermenting vegetables, just because you don't need to obtain a special starter culture. It's all on the vegetables. You don't need special equipment. You can use a jar that's already sitting around in your kitchen. There's no case history of food poisoning or illness. So in terms of, people's projections of fear upon bacterially rich foods, there's absolutely no reason to be afraid. Plus it's easy, it's delicious, it's supportive of good health, and you can enjoy your results relatively quickly. So I generally recommend that people start with fermenting vegetables, something like sauerkraut. But cultured foods can be very easy as well. Kombucha, you have to obtain a culture, but once you have it, the process of making kombucha with that culture is very straightforward. Yogurt involves a little bit of temperature manipulation, so that makes it a little bit harder, but it's not that hard. You just, heat up the milk to about 180 degrees, cool it down to about 110 degrees, introduce the culture, and then you have to rig up something to incubate it and maintain it around 110 degrees Fahrenheit. I just use an insulated cooler that I preheat with hot water. So I try to keep things low tech and approachable for people to think about doing in their home kitchens. I mean, people have been practicing fermentation for at least 10,000 years with tools that are much simpler than what you'll find in any of our contemporary home kitchens. So we definitely can do it in our contemporary kitchen.
So what compelled you to write The Art of Fermentation in your other books?
I got interested in fermentation, largely through the experience of having a garden for the first time and realizing that all of the cabbage is ready at the same time. And so as a result of that, I learned how to make sauerkraut. And then one thing led to another, and I just became obsessed with all things fermented. But what I realized as I began to share it with people is people projected all of this fear on it. Like, okay, sauerkraut is a bacterially rich food, so how do I know that I have good bacteria growing in my sauerkraut and not bad bacteria that might make my family sick or even kill someone? So I just realized that, because of this general, cultural fear of bacteria, and, that's our indoctrination into what I would describe as the war on bacteria, this sort of idea that bacteria in general are bad, people, became very fearful of these, important fermented foods. And so I decided that I would try to demystify fermentation for people and make it more approachable. And I did that first in a couple of small workshops, and I realized how exciting and satisfying that was. And then I wrote a little zine that I self-published, and that led me into writing a book, which led me into further teaching, and then ultimately another book. Fermentation is a vast, vast subject. I mean, there are different fermentation traditions everywhere, and you know, and some of the traditions that have spread far, you know, there are distinctive local variations everywhere. So I mean, I just find it to be endlessly fascinating learning about fermentation, and also really, really fun to demystify it and people see how easy and safe it is. And in fact, you know, fermentation has been a strategy for food safety. You know, and in general, the process of fermentation actually makes food safer than it starts out being.
So in the Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, you cite studies on the health benefits of fermented foods, as well as talk about how eating fermented foods have helped you with your own wellness and living with HIV. Can you share with us how fermented foods have helped you personally, but also what those health benefits are for everyone?
There's so many different fermented foods that it's hard to generalize. I mean, obviously, you know, salami, bread, yogurt, sauerkraut, and chocolate do not have, you know, identical nutritional qualities. You know, but the process of fermentation definitely transforms foods in some clear patterns of ways. So the first one I would describe is predigestion, and this is the idea that you know, complex nutrients, some of which can be difficult for us to digest, get broken down into simpler forms before we eat them. So nutrients become more bioavailable. Minerals and foods become much more bioavailable. Then there's what I would describe as detoxification, which is really the same thing as predigestion, except instead of nutritive compounds being broken down, it's toxic compounds being broken down into benign forms. And there are examples of foods all around the world that are toxic without fermentation and become safe to eat as a result of fermentation. Nutrients that are produced by the bacteria. So rather than just breaking down within the raw food that you're beginning with, it's metabolic byproducts of the bacteria. You know, some of these are B vitamins, and in general, fermented foods have higher levels of B vitamins than the raw foods that you begin with. And some of these are unique micronutrients that are really just beginning to be explored. But, you know, for instance, in sauerkraut, there are compounds called isothiocyanates that are regarded as anti-carcinogenic, that are metabolic byproducts of the bacteria as they digest vegetables. Then finally, what I would consider to be the most profound nutritional benefit of fermentation would be live bacterial cultures. Not all fermented foods have live bacterial cultures. A loaf of bread coming out of the oven, the bacteria have been killed by heat. A can of sauerkraut sitting unrefrigerated on a shelf in the supermarket, that also has been heat processed, killing the bacteria. But fermented foods that are not heated or cooked after their fermentation contain living bacterial cultures, in many cases dominated by lactic acid bacteria. They can help to replenish and diversify the bacteria in our own intestine. And also they stimulate the immune system. It seems that they stimulate some of the brain chemistry. And so, you know, really every week there are new studies, you know, demonstrating just how important bacteria are to every aspect of our health and well-being. So, I mean, in terms of my personal health, I mean, sure, I've been living with HIV for, 24 years now. And, you know, I take HIV meds. I mean, I wish the story I could tell you was just eating fermented foods, prevented the HIV from progressing in my body, and that's not really the case. But I can tell you that the meds that I take, most of the other people who I've met who take them have digestive problems as a result of them, and I've never had that. So I think that the fermented foods help keep my digestion healthy. My overall immune function has been great, and, you know, bacteria definitely play a huge role in our immune function. And so, you know, I think that, you know, regularly, you know, eating these bacterially rich foods has something to do with that. Unfortunately, there is a limited amount of, structured research about this, clinical trials. I mean, you know, there's a vast body of clinical trials for probiotic capsules because those are all proprietary, and the owners of those proprietary strains, conduct these expensive trials to demonstrate their effectiveness at all sorts of things. But nobody owns the traditional ferments, and so nobody's really investing in trials like that. So there's some evidence, but a lot of it is anecdotal. I mean, the latest bit of anecdotal evidence, which was very interesting, was that, you know, young people who eat sauerkraut experience less social anxiety. All sorts of, you know, aspects of, you know, well-being can definitely be affected by the health of the bacterial communities in our intestines. And it goes way beyond, you know, digestion and immune function.
So what do you think the next piece of research that needs to be done? Just looking into the natural probiotics that are in ferments themselves, or is there some more substantial or other types of research out
there? Yeah, sure. I mean, I would love to see clinical trials of, you know, just eating traditional fermented foods. I mean, it's not a question of not knowing what bacteria are in them. You know, I mean, they're broad communities of bacteria. Whenever you take, you know, raw natural ingredients, it's not like there's a single bacteria. You know, single bacteria is very much a technological idea. 150 years ago, Louis Pasteur did that for the first time. In the natural world, a single bacterium never existed. You know, bacteria exist in communities. And so, you know, all of the traditional ferments actually are embodiments of broad communities of bacteria. And frankly, that's what, you know, that's why I believe they're more powerful probiotic agents than capsules that contain, you know, a billion copies of one or two cells.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that it's been so helpful for you in your healing, and also others you've talked to.
But I try to be very, very careful. I mean, I hear reports from people all the time who tell me that their digestion has, you know, dramatically improved, or that other health problems have. You know, but I think that, you know, there are also are people who are making, you know, unsubstantiated claims. You know, there are people out there who say, like, oh, drinking kombucha is going to cure diabetes. And I think that it is unreasonable to expect a particular food to cure a particular disease. And we have to look, you know, more broadly and say that as a group, these bacterially rich foods can improve digestion, they can improve overall immune function, they might improve mental health, and they represent no risk. And they can be very helpful, but I don't think it's reasonable, and I've been trying very hard to not promote the idea that, you know, eating a lot of sauerkraut is, you know, will reverse HIV or anything else. It's much more general than that.
Right. Okay, let's shift gears here a little bit. There's a lot of interest and history in Kodiak and living off the land, collecting wild plants like seaweed and fiddleheads, collecting blueberries, salmonberries. Right now there's tons of salmonberries showing up, fishing. I know we can ferment most anything, but do you have any recommendations for fermenting these local foods that would taste especially good?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, where I live in Tennessee, there's a great tradition that people call country wine. And that would be like blackberry wine, elderberry wine. But you can use exactly the same techniques with, you know, salmon berries or other kinds of berries. So anywhere that is, you know, where people have access to abundant berries, I mean, I would encourage them to make simple country wines. I mean, my basic recipe would be fill up a crock or vessel with berries. The more berries you have, the better. Guesstimate, you know, roughly what the volume that the berries are filling, and figure about half that volume, mix up a sugar water solution, about one part water, six parts water to one part sugar. So you make a sugar water solution, cover the berries in that, and then just stir it every day. Cover the, you know, stir the berries in the water really vigorously, and it'll start to bubble. Keep stirring them. You know, after about a week of bubbling, there's hardly any color or flavor left in the berries, and the color has all migrated into the solution. There's more liquid because the berries have lost most of their liquid into the solution. Strain it out. Either enjoy it young as a very lightly fermented, still sweet wine, or else get it into an airlocked vessel and ferment it for a couple of months, and then bottle it, and then, you know, you can enjoy a berry wine. You know, that's one great thing you can do. If you have fiddleheads or greens or just vegetables from a garden, I would recommend, you know, fermenting vegetables. I mean, sauerkraut is generally what I'd recommend, you know, is the first thing for anybody to make. And, you know, if we have a couple of minutes, I could just describe the process for making sauerkraut.
Sure, go ahead.
Great. We leave vegetables out exposed to air, especially if we chop them up and make lots of surface area. That air exposure is going to support the growth of mold. And so our strategy for getting the lactic acid bacteria to dominate rather than the mold is to get the vegetables submerged. We could just pour water over them, but the water would dilute the flavors. So typically what we try to do is pull the water out of the vegetables. So you chop them up, you lightly salt them. I really recommend just salting to taste if you have no idea what to do with that. You know, think about, 1.5% salt by weight. But just lightly salt it. There's no magic number. Just you trust your taste buds, and it doesn't have to be extremely salty at all. Just lightly salt them. The salt starts pulling juice out of the vegetables, and I like to get in there with my hands, especially if I'm doing a small batch, and just squeeze the vegetables hard for a couple of minutes. What you're doing is breaking down cell walls, bruising the vegetables, helping the cells release their juices. And you'll notice that the vegetables, after 5 minutes of that, get really juicy. You pick up a handful and squeeze it, and it's like a sponge, and juice comes out. Then you can fill your vessel. I would recommend using jars, like wide-mouth quart-sized jars. A quart takes about 2 pounds of vegetables, and you just sort of stuff it into the jar with some force, fill the jar nearly to the top, leave a little bit of space for expansion, press down the vegetables hard so you're forcing the solids down and liquids up so the vegetables become submerged. Then I like to ferment it right on my kitchen counter so I can loosen the top and release the pressure that's going to build up, because this is a life process that involves the production of carbon dioxide, so you have to release some pressure. And then while I do that, I press down and make sure the vegetables get submerged, and after 3 or 4 days of that, I start tasting it. And, you know, some people love their fermented vegetables mild after just, 3 or 4 days. People, you can leave them, especially if you have an unheated space, like a cellar. I mean, you could leave them, for months and months and months, and they'll be just fine. I mean, this has been a strategy for survival in temperate places with limited growing seasons, and it's very easy to make. What I've described is a small scale, a quart. But, I also do this in 55-gallon oak barrels, and you could do it in any scale in between, in a gallon jar, a plastic bucket, a ceramic crock. There's lots of different vessels you can use, but a wide-mouth jar is something that's easily available and you might have in your kitchen already.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask one last question here. Kodiak has a ton of slugs, which gardeners are in constant battle with. And in your book, you mention an old-time method of pest control where one collects and then ferments a pest and then sprays it on the plant. Have you tried this method? Does it work? Could it work with slugs?
I couldn't tell you if it works with slugs. I have tried it with some other pests with mixed results, but I've never tried it with slugs. Right where I live, I don't have a big slug problem. One summer I gardened in Maine and we had a big slug problem, and what I found worked really well was putting cups of beer out and the slugs would drown in the beer. But it would be a great thing to try.
Senator Katz, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Cover. Until next time, happy reading.
Thank you, Tatum. Look forward to some more interviews coming up on future shows of Dog-Eared Reads. Kodiak Public Library Association's making plans for future activities. We're working on little free libraries. This is a nationwide movement where people set up little boxes for books, either in their front yard, at their place of business, in public places. The motto is, take one, share one. So you might find a book you want to give away, you put it in the little free library, and you take another one. This is something where you would actually build a container for your own space or somewhere in your neighborhood. We're just getting started with this activity, so if you're interested, please contact us and let us know of your interest. We hope to be working on it through the winter and building little free libraries that we can set up around the community come spring. In September, we're looking forward to a visit by nationally acclaimed author Nancy Lord, who writes about the environment and about Alaska and scientific things. She's just published a new book called pH, about the warming of the oceans, and she'll be visiting Kodiak on September 18th to be a part of our Constitution Day presentation. Be looking forward to more information about this event, but it will be happening at the Kodiak Public Library on the evening of September 18th.
And you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Kodiak Public Library Association's show for book lovers of all ages on KODK 90.7 Kodiak, Alaska. Please consider becoming a member of the Kodiak Public Library Association. KPLA memberships and donations help to support the public library's programming and collections, to host events such as the Crabfest book sale, and more. To join, stop by the library or visit us online at kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. Thank you for your support.
Up next on Dog-Eared Reads today, a good friend of mine, Lexa Meyer, is joining me in the studio. She is one of the friends that I go to when I have gardening questions. She has a lot of knowledge and some book reviews she'd like to share with us. I'm actually really excited because other than giving you some good books about gardening, Lexa has also brought in some good fiction books that feature gardening in their plot. And I thought that would be a good thing to do, not just to focus on all technical textbooks, but also to focus on some of the more fun summer reads you garden-loving people out there might want to enjoy. So I'm going to turn it over now to Lexa to share with you what she brought.
Great. Well, thank you, Tia, for inviting me. I have two fiction books and two nonfiction books to talk about today. I'll start with nonfiction. These are two of my favorites. They're not technical manuals on gardening per se, but they both have a lot of really interesting information about the history of gardening, the importance of heirlooms. We hear a lot about things like heirlooms and hybrids and GMOs and all this stuff these days. And really, these two books stress the importance of plants as they were when we first discovered them and raised them for agricultural use, and then how we've modified them to suit our purposes and sometimes not for the better. The first book I'd like to talk about is just a really fun read. It's very inspirational. It's about a couple, Jer and Emily Gessel, how you say their name. And they started Baker Creek Seeds, and a lot of garden people are familiar with them. They're based out of Missouri and now have seed stores on the East Coast, West Coast, and then they're in the center of the United States. They're just fabulous. They specialize. They're total plant nerds. And they met online and started this empire of beautiful heirlooms from all over the world. They were currently just in Japan. I follow them on their Instagram account. And they wrote this lovely book featuring some of their favorite heirloom varieties, the history of Baker Creek Seeds, the company they started. They give some gardening advice and tips and growing things in the book. But it's really just a fabulous read with gorgeous pictures. I mean, I like to call it plant porn. I mean, the photos are beautiful if you enjoy gorgeous heirloom vegetables. And that is available at the Kodiak Public Library. And
what's it called?
It's called The Heirloom Life Gardener. And it's just a beautiful book, Heirloom Life Gardener by Jer and Emily Kessel. And it's just beautiful.
And so they actually founded this company where you get a lot of your seeds from.
They did. They did. Yeah. Jer actually started it when he was like 17 years old and did it out of his bedroom because he had favorite plant varieties he'd grown growing up in Missouri and in Colorado as a kid. And then he decided to start his own seed company. And it just took off from there because he was featuring heirloom varieties that people hadn't been able to find for decades. Of course, he got online and then the word kind of spread on the online community and his seed sales just exploded.
Can you very briefly, for people that might not be very into gardening and might not know what an heirloom is, can you describe that?
Sure, yeah. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Heirlooms are... And now they've kind of changed the definition of an heirloom. It's not something that has to be 100 or 200 years old. It's just a variety now that can be propagated from seed. So a lot of plants, garden varieties, are actually hybrids where they're crossed by two plants, and it's what we call the F1 or the first generation of that cross of those two plants makes a really vigorous, happy plant. But unfortunately, because it's a cross, if you were to pollinate even two of the same individuals of those hybrids, you wouldn't necessarily get a offspring of those plants that would hold true to its characteristics because it will pull out parent genes from the two parents and may kind of give irregular results. Heirlooms are ones you can take the seeds and they'll grow the same plant year after year after year. And that's kind of what the definition of an heirloom has been changed to. So it's not necessarily something that your great-great-grandma had to grow. There's people that are actually generating new heirlooms as we speak. And tomatoes are one of those vastly evolving heirloom varieties.
typically, if you're buying your seeds from many of the places around town, those seeds, while they might give you a plant that has seeds, you wouldn't be able to replant those seeds growing from your plant and find it successful.
Yeah, you might get success, but it wouldn't hold true to the parent type. Things like summer squash, especially, a lot of the most popular varieties grown in the United States are actually F1 cross hybrids. And so you couldn't save seeds from those zucchinis, say, and expect to get the same results next year.
But if you get your seeds from...
If you get heirloom seeds, you can then save your seeds, and you could have plants for generations to come. And sometimes you might have to breed a little bit of vigor back in by bringing in some new genetics. But you could save those for years, which is really cool.
Okay. What's your other book, Lexa?
My other nonfiction book is The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan. And a lot of people have read that book. His writings are very popular. But again, that book remains one of my favorite plant books because it talks about the human interrelationships and how plants have changed human society. And sometimes for good and sometimes for not so good. He talks about three different plants. He talks about apples. He talks about tulips. He talks about cannabis. And he talks about potatoes and how the growing of those said things has shaped commerce, how they've shaped, you know, how what we come to perceive as now an apple is something very different, of course, from the original apple or crab apples or wild apples. And how there used to be, you know, thousands and thousands of varieties of, say, apples, and now there's only like a handful that you can find in the supermarket. And it's the pursuit of sweetness and this kind of really... It's something completely different than what an apple really actually is or was. I like to talk about tulips. Tulips became a commodity in Europe because they were so highly valued, and they were worth more than gold at a certain point in certain areas of Europe, which is just insane. And it was all just because they were beautiful. Of course, they have no food value, but it was just for the sake of the beauty of the tulip. And then cannabis, of course, we all know why cannabis is important, because of course it gets us high. But the other thing it does too is that we're now finding is that there are probably some medical applications for that plant. And it started out as a plant that was grown mostly for fiber, and then people realized you could get high off of it. And then we've completely changed that plant from its ancestor hemp now to a plant that's, I mean, how many varieties must there be now of that particular plant? So that's one we've definitely taken and changed to suit our needs. And then finally, the potato. And everyone is, of course, familiar with potatoes. We eat potatoes all the time. There used to be thousands of varieties of potatoes growing, and now there's just a handful of potatoes that are grown commercially. I mean, you get russets, Yukon Golds, and you put red new potatoes at the store, and that's about it. You know, we're starting to see things like purple potatoes, and those things show up on grocery store shelves. But he talks heavily about the Irish potato famine and how that was a result of growing only one variety of potato. Whereas if they had been growing multiple varieties, they may have averted that disaster because some of them may have been immune to the potato blight. But because they put so much trust in one crop and one specific variety of that crop, that's what caused almost a million people to die. And it was very, very sad.
So this is less a book about gardening techniques and more really just a study of
the sociological
impact of what humans have done to agriculture.
Exactly. So it gives a kind of a different spin from a nonfiction perspective on gardening, which I thoroughly appreciate.
And this author, what's his name again?
Michael Pollan.
Right.
He's written other books, The Omnivore's Dilemma, where he talks about food and our relationship to food. Yeah, there's some really, really good books that he's written.
Yeah, I thought that it might be important to mention that. So if you read The Omnivore's Dilemma and you like that author, this is another one of his great books to read.
All right. And then I have two fiction books, and these are really, really fun books. One's a little more serious than the other. The first one is by an author. Her name is Barbara Kingsolver, and she's a fabulous author. She's written many, many books. Her book, Prodigal Summer, is my favorite by far. I love that book. She kind of chronicles a year in the life of these people in this small town in the Ozarks. And it's just a beautiful story. And it shows just how wonderfully tied these people's lives are to the earth. And some of the characters are just studying the natural environment. And others are actively participating in it. They're farming. They're growing things. It's just a beautiful, beautiful book. And she therein talks about the importance of heirloom varieties and how in America alone there used to be, you know, back in the 1920s, like hundreds and thousands of different varieties of all these different plants that were grown worldwide in the United States. And then that number was compressed greatly with kind of this big agricultural revolution that happened post-World War. And now there's just a handful of varieties of things we see in the grocery store. And that's really a shame because there were so many that were wonderful. And a lot of those are lost now. They're now functionally extinct. They're just gone. She talks about that. And it's just a beautiful book. She really gives a nice sense of place. It can be a little heavy at times. You know, there's a big poignant message. But it's a very good read. I don't want to spoil too much about it. But
and say it again in title for me?
Prodigal Summer.
Prodigal Summer by Barbara Kingsolver.
Barbara Kingsolver, yes. Mm-hmm.
And your last book is a lot more lighthearted, isn't it?
Oh, it's super fun. It's just a beautiful read. And all the characters are involved in gardening or agriculture in some way. They're just adorable. It's by an author. Her name is Bailey White, and you may recognize her. She's been on NPR. And she's just a fabulous writer. And her book, this is the book I just love, is called Quite a Year for Plums. And it's a funny title. There's really no plot. It just chronicles the kind of everyday goings-on and funny anecdotes from a group of people living in a little small town in southern Georgia. And it's super cute. Love that book. The characters are wonderful. The two main characters, they're actually older women, which I super appreciate. You know, they're often... You know, women as we age, we're not well represented in literature. And if we are, we're kind of marginalized. And they're really kind of the main characters, which I appreciate a great deal. Yeah, and it's just really fun. It talks about, you know, people that have lived there their entire lives, how people that come to visit interact with those people. And it's just really a fun read.
So is this written from the point of view of one of the old ladies? Is it a third person? Or
no, it's not a third person. It's first person. And you're just talking to the different people and popping in little different scenarios in everyone's lives. It's very cute. I mean, for everything from a day spent trimming a plum tree to a day spent out in the woods, the two main characters, they'd bring their rocking chairs out into the forest. And they like to sit and just rock in their rocking chairs. And enjoy a quiet evening in the South. And it's really cute.
So it's not a plot-driven specific story with like a climate. It's a series of anecdotes about this small town
exactly.
with these characters.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. Sounds pretty lighthearted and good for people that love gardening to have a light summer read.
Definitely, yeah. And the ladies grow a beautiful garden. They talk about making vidala onion pies and all sorts of things with what they grow in their garden. It's just wonderful. I like it quite a bit.
And I would like to mention, I think you told me the other night, I want to share this with everybody, that you actually read this book every summer. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Oh, yeah. It was actually a book I found at the SetNet site, and I just let it live down there, and I love it so much I read it every year because I it's like coming back home and getting to know the characters again. It's just something fun, you know, when you have one of those rainy afternoons in the cabin, and it's a book. It's a very short read. You can read it in a day if you want to. And you could just curl up with a good book and a cup of hot chocolate and watch the rain fall.
I really like that story, the idea of going out to the SetNet site and having a look on the cabin bookshelf walls and finding this book that you end up enjoying so much that it becomes a yearly ritual to read it again. That's fantastic. I have a lot of books that are at our SetNet site, but I haven't found one yet that's worth rereading every summer. So I definitely have to pick up
Quite a Year for Plums.
Quite a Year for Plums.
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
My husband loves the title. He likes to make fun of it, but it's a darling book.
Great. Thanks, Lexa. And I guess before you go, I would say, do you have a tip that you'd like to share or maybe important piece of advice you'd like to give to all of us out there that may not be very good gardeners, that maybe something simple that we can all take home to our gardens to use to improve it over the summer?
Yes, and I just had something happen today. It's my best bit of advice to someone getting started gardening is don't give up. I had a major setback in my gardening world. Some of my starts have kicked the bucket for no reason. Aww. I'm going to get to the bottom of it, but I have to restart a bunch of things. So start early and don't give up. Because Aww. Even if you've done this, you know, this will be my, 11th year gardening in Alaska. Don't give up. Sometimes you have little setbacks, but that's all they are. Plants are amazing. They'll catch up fast.
Oh, that is good advice. Yeah, not to get discouraged as you're learning if there's what seems to be failures. It's just opportunity for learning and growth.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you, Lexa, for coming in.
You're welcome. It was great coming in. Thanks.
It was fun. Definitely sharing all those books has been a great opportunity to find some good reads for myself over this summer. So I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was interesting. And some good books that were reviewed and tips on how to grow things. Do you like to read? Do you like to listen to books? I do. Hi, I'm Lori Madsen. I would like to tell you about Listen Alaska, a free service offered by the Alaska Digital Library, in part from the Kodiak Public Library. It's accessible from a computer, tablet, or a phone. You can listen directly from the browser on your computer or use an OverDrive app on a smartphone or a tablet. They have featured collections that include fiction of various genres for all ages, a wealth of nonfiction titles, and all the battle of the books. You can borrow up to 10 items at a time, and you can put anything on hold that'll be ready for you once it's checked back in. The lending period may vary from title to title, but the maximum is 21 days, and they can be renewed. A really cool feature of this service is when the audiobook or ebook is due, it disappears from your device. No more overdue fines or worrying about getting that item back to the library on time. To get started, you will need to have an active library card to borrow titles. Please visit the Kodiak Public Library and get your PIN, personal identification number, that will allow you to sign on to the Alaska Digital Library and start using it. What? Don't have a library card? Any permanent resident of the Kodiak Island Borough is eligible for a library card. New patrons are asked to show two pieces of identification that have their current mailing address in Kodiak on it, and parental permission is required for children under the age of 15. But once you have your PIN and your library card, you can log into OverDrive on your computer. The URL is listenalaska.lib.overdrive.com. Or do a simple search for Listen Alaska and you will find the URL. You can also download the app from iTunes or an Android source, and it's a great way to read more and keep learning. I like to listen to a story while I'm driving and then continue reading it later at a more convenient time. Or with more difficult texts, I listen as I follow along in a book. Quite often, our public library has the print version, and then I borrow the audio version from the digital library. It's all free, and it's available 24/7 from Listen Alaska. Check it out! Next up, we have Sarah Purcellin reading from Gaining Daylight, essays by Sarah Lowen.
There are a number of talented writers who call Kodiak Island home, one of whom I will be featuring today. Sarah Lowen grew up on Kodiak Island and in 2013 published a book of essays titled Gaining Daylight, Life on Two Islands. The book is a treasure of stories about Kodiak and Sarah's life growing up in Alaska and fishing from a set net site on Amuk Island with her husband and children. Her delightful essays touch on history, fishing, growing up, and motherhood, and I highly recommend the book for a glimpse into Kodiak's past and present. Given that salmon fishing season is in full swing, I have chosen to read an essay set at Sarah's fish camp, titled Unsinkable. I grew up around boats, but it was my older brother Reuben who learned how to drive a skiff and repair an outboard motor. On family fishing trips when we were kids, my sister Mary Beth and I were content to trail ribbons tied to Care Bears or My Little Ponies in the wake. I rode in the bow with canine enthusiasm, gulping in wind that tangled my hair into knots that could not be combed out. It was exhilarating just to be going, to be moving over the waves. This was one reason I asked for a skiff of my own after my first season at the fish site. I wanted the feeling of going. And there's another reason. Although I'm not yet confident on the water, I want our children to grow up riding in Mom's boat, too. This summer, my third season in Uyak, I got my first skiff, a 17-foot 1960s Boston Whaler with a two-stroke 60-horsepower Yamaha. Before her retirement 10 years ago, she was one of the main fishing skiffs at her set net site, hauling hundreds of thousands of salmon. This was the first skiff Peter worked from as a full crewman when he was 13. He remembers salmon floating around his boats when they picked the nets in rough seas. The sides are low, and when waves broke over the bow, they sometimes washed fish out of the transom. Now we fish from large aluminum skiffs that can hold more and are better suited to our rocky beaches. When Peter hauled the old whaler out of the beach grass, she needed a few repairs. The crewman who did much of the fiberglass work used to make surfboards in California. He treated the whaler as if she were a longboard instead of a 50-year-old boat. She's watertight and solid, but she could use a paint job. The skiff is aqua, with yellow fiberglass patches on her hull that make me think of roller skating knees. I was nervous when I first took the skiff to Larsen Bay. You're sure it won't sink? I asked Peter. You could chainsaw this in half with a person sitting in both ends, and they would both keep floating, he said. This skiff could fill with water, and it would still float. I wish I didn't know that this information came from old Boston Whaler commercials. I wish I didn't know that his information came from old Boston Whaler commercials. Boston Whaler, the unsinkable legend! But I figured this trip had to be smoother than my past attempts in other boats. The first time I was alone in one of our aluminum skiffs was during a gale. We were driving two skiffs side by side, but Peter anticipated and adjusted for the waves, while I clung to the steering wheel and managed to plow into each one. It was like aiming for potholes. Water knocked my hood back and streamed under my rain gear and into my boots. I'd been scared when we started out, but pretty soon that changed to fury. At each dose of icy water, at the fear knotting my stomach, at the storm, at Peter, at this place where even going home at night was hard. That same summer, on a clear afternoon, I'd made my first solo crossing of Uyak Bay. I hadn't been off of Emuk for days and was motivated by the thought of visiting my mother-in-law, Jan, to talk about books over a cup of coffee, to talk about anything, really, with another person. I pushed a camouflaged duck-hunting raft off the beach and jumped in. Earlier in the week, my father-in-law had assured me of its seaworthiness and then shared a story about towing it behind the skiff one October and looking up to see the raft soaring like a kite behind the boat. I had one passenger, Schooner, our chocolate lab, riding in the bow. To steer with a tiller handle required perching on a tubular side a few feet from the ocean. That was fine in calm water, but by the middle of the bay, the waves grew too big to see over. Suddenly, the little raft felt more like an inflatable wading pool. I was afraid it would flip. I couldn't predict the next roll of ocean. The swells were disorienting. My in-laws were surprised to see the raft across the water. They would spot it, and then it would disappear a while before bobbing back into view. Schooner paced with his tail between his legs. I'd gone too far to turn back. No way out but through, I recited, in between praying and hollering at the dog to sit down. Sometimes during a particularly rough skiff ride, I try to imagine how it would feel in a kayak, and I think of Aramunk Gideon's account as he inspected Kodiak for the Russian Orthodox Church in 1804. My heart was filled with sorrow. After calm weather and fog, a strong, most cruel wind arose, accompanied by adverse current. The paddlers tired. The weather grew worse. The swells constantly rolled over us, Gideon wrote. From great exertion, blood spurted from the noses of the paddlers. We expected imminent destruction. God be praised, we reached a deserted shore, but just barely. When I head to the village of Larsen Bay in the Whaler, I drive slowly until the butterflies sink. I pass the channel markers and hear my brother's voice from a sailing trip in college. Red, right, returning. I pass the Russian Orthodox Church and Frenchie's Point, where crows are rising off the bluff like bits of ash from a campfire. Driving the skiff is like hosting a bicycle down a long hill or kicking toward blue sky on a swing set. It gives me back the feeling of freedom I've missed. Outside the cabin windows, my skiff nods from the mooring line as the changing season shows in stronger wind and waves. Soon, we'll put the skiffs away for winter. With her engine fogged and flushed, the Whaler will sit dry in the warehouse until spring. Next summer, I'll take my son beachcombing or berry picking in this skiff. On the way to his grandparents' cabin, we'll look for otters and seals at the haul-out rock. I'll take my dad and mom fishing when they fly out to Uyak for a visit. There is a fist pointing forward on the bow that a crewman painted in the 80s. It points in various directions depending on the wind. This way to Katmai. This way to the head of Uyak Bay, with its Kodiak bears, dark as molasses. This way to Cape Town, Sydney, San Francisco, Shanghai. I would never venture as far as Shelikof Strait, but I like thinking about the ocean we share, traveling on an element that moves with the sky and moon and the earth below it. No lanes, just always changing open space. After the salmon season ends, we like to stay a month or so out at the site. There's still work to do, but a kind of quiet settles around the bay. The radio goes silent after the fishing boats and set net families have stored their gear and left for winter homes. In the fall, the light is soft, and everything else is crisp. The breeze and night skies and the sharp smell of herbs when I empty pots into the garden. We remark on the changes in wildlife that seem to signal the impending winter. The halibut aren't in the same spots. The bears are coming around more often. We spend a day watching humpback whales breach just a few hundred yards from the cabin while a pod of orcas circle the bay. When Peter points out the arrival of ducks migrating overhead, Liam responds by pointing and mimicking his favorite bird this summer, chickadee. The Bakars were our last visitors this year. They brought their new baby Henry, a cooler full of fresh fruit and vegetables, bottles of wine. We're lucky our family and friends don't mind the work of getting to Emuk Island. The hour flight to Kodiak, another 30-minute flight on a small plane to Larsen Bay, which is often delayed by bad weather. Then a skiff ride across Uyak. I always wish for a landing craft instead of an aluminum skiff when older relatives visit, struggling to hoist stiff legs over the high sides of the boat. Seeing their appreciation always renews my own gratitude for the beauty around us. Company is also a good excuse to pull out the kayaks or drop the crab pots. Misty and I went kayaking on a morning so calm that the loudest sounds were fin whales breathing and the splash of kittiwakes diving. Mostly we floated without paddling, watching harbor porpoises and seals surface around us. One night before the moon was out, we drifted in the skiff to see bioluminescence glimmering in the black water. We splashed the ocean over and over, sending trails of sparks shooting away from the paddle's slap. The skiff's wake swirled a glowing green path behind us. Wading into the water that night, each step of our boots was like kicking up stars. As we close up the cabin, bears leave their tracks along the tide line flecked with the gold of the last cottonwood leaves. When Peter drains the water line, he finds their wide prints in the trampled mud and water shooting up from the bear bites in the pipe. Last winter, our setnetter friends in neighboring Uganic Bay had a bear in their cabin. It climbed through a window and leapt through the wall. When we leave, we board up the doors and windows and hope we won't return to a mess of bear scat and chewed up couches and mattresses. We also empty the pantry, which makes for interesting meals. For several days, we cook giant omelets to use up the eggs and garden onions. I've heard subsistence described as always getting ready, and it rings true with every seasonal transition in Alaska. I think of winterizing as always trying to guess what nature might destroy while we're away. Something will inevitably freeze or break. But we try to take things down that an earthquake could shake from the walls and store the solar panels and anything else the wind might take. I shouldn't admit it, but I find it almost as satisfying to put the garden beds to rest as it is to plant the first seeds in May. When I rake compost and seaweed over the cabbage leaves and broccoli stems, I imagine the soil resting under a layer of snow, and it feels like making peace with the end of another season. By November, we've moved into the town of Kodiak. It's back to marking time with days of the week and dates on the calendar, back to telephones ringing, seat belts, and grocery stores. In the winter, it's the small things that I'll miss from our season at the fish site, like having time to write a real letter and starting the day with a slow walk in a quiet place.
This is Sarah Lowen, author of Gaining Daylight, Life on Two Islands, and contributor to Made of Salmon, Alaskan Stories from the Salmon Project. And you are listening to KODK 90.7, Kodiak, Alaska.